Thank you, and let me say it's a pleasure to be here. When I came up here and sat up here earlier on, I took off my coat, as is my habit, and Terry said to me, "You know, you're in Melbourne now, not Sydney." And I wondered whether that was a comment about the culture or about the temperature. And I actually still don't know. Nothing to do, of course, with what I'm going to talk about. I essentially want to give you a top-down approach, if you like. I want to start by giving you my views about the rest of the world and also the current state of the Australian economy. I had a quick look at what I wrote, and I wrote it 3.5 months ago. It's in the book. And I have to say most of it still stands up fairly well. My growth forecast for Australia, I think, wouldn't be changed a bit. I was pessimistic about the US economy at the time, and that seems to have been pessimism seems to have been validated since then. I was, however, a little too over-optimistic about inflation in Australia, and that has some implications that I will come back to about interest rates. I just wanted to assure you that, in talking to you about the world economy and then the Australian economy, I have taken my responsibilities for today very seriously indeed. On your behalf, in recent months, I've travelled. And I've visited two of the great economic powerhouses of the world. I've been to China and I've been to New Zealand. The New Zealand visit was, if anything, the more memorable one. I go there every year for a week's worth of presentations, and on this occasion I thought, you know, I'll just go in early and I'll take the weekend beforehand. I'll make it a long weekend and just spend a bit of personal time there. And I stayed in a small town up in what they call the Northland, near where the Bay of Islands is. And I discovered how small the town was on the Saturday morning when I went into the newsagent and I said to the bloke, "Can I get a copy of the paper?" And he said to me, "Do you want today's paper or do you want yesterday's paper?" And I thought that was a strange thing to say, but I said, "I'd like today's paper, please." And he said, "You have to come back tomorrow." When you think about it, we can do that all again tomorrow. But as I said, nothing to do with what I want to talk about. This is working so far, a global economic and market outlook. I thought I'd start in the United States, and I thought I'd show you some pictures, essentially, of how the United States economy got to where it is now. This is the, if you like, the culprit. Red line here shows you housing starts in the US, and I could show you almost any other picture relating to housing, and it looks pretty much the same. Boom, followed by bust. And housing starts, for example, the most recent figures show that from that peak, just 2 years ago, housing starts are down more than 50%. Now, it's important to point out that this housing slide began when subprime was still a grade of hamburger meat. So subprime did not cause this fall, although I guess it's sort of, we're now in the state where it's chicken and egg. That extraordinary housing boom, of course, led to rising house prices, which sucked in a lot of subprime borrowers who presumably thought, well, at the end of the honeymoon period when they put the rate up on me, that the very worst, I can sell the house for 20% more than I paid for it. And of course, at the end of the honeymoon period, when they put the rate up on them, they discovered they couldn't do that. The loan was now bigger than the value of the house, and among other things, that makes it difficult to refinance. So it's true that the housing slump has fed upon itself. Because of the nature of the subprime problem. But housing's a very cyclical industry, but you don't get falls this big except on the way into recession. However, so far, the feed-through, if you like, from the fall in starts to construction spending in the US has been relatively mild. This is just a year-two rate of growth of construction spending. You can see it's negative right now. It's true, and that second dip is looking a bit ominous, but over on the far left is what really happens, what happens during a major construction recession. And the explanation for this, actually, is that residential construction has fallen big time in the past year, but non-res and public construction have really been surprisingly strong. So going forward, I think it's actually, you know, if you believe that housing can't continue to fall at the rate that it has been falling, because it's going to go out of existence altogether if it does, you could be quite optimistic about construction spending, but you have to wonder how long the non-res and the public bits are going to hold up. A lot of non-res and public, of course, is infrastructure related to expansion of cities. It's shopping centres, it's new roads, it's new infrastructure, it's hospitals and whatever that follow houses. So oddly enough, residential construction spending will stop falling sometime in the near future, but the other components of construction may continue to go down. Now, just looking at an indicator that that covers the entire economy, and this chart I put in the overview, but it looks significantly worse since that date. This is a three-month moving average of employment growth. You can spot the two recessions, and you can see what's happening now. It's. I suppose some people might think, well, you could still avoid recession, but it's starting to look very, very ominous, isn't it? And indeed, the employment in the private sector has fallen in each of the past 3 months for which we have data. And as far as I'm concerned, when you hear that, you put down the glasses. And I think it's reasonable. You should reasonably conclude right now that the US economy is already in recession. And, of course, in the past, we've known that that's... well, not been good for the Australian economy, and this one probably won't be either. Do not believe for 1 minute what you've heard about decoupling, if you like, whereby the US tanks and everybody else goes on as if nothing's happened. It's not going to happen. Now, things don't have to be too bad, of course, in the US if the recession there is mild. And you can make a very strong case for a mild recession in the US. As I've already suggested, housing can't possibly keep falling at the rate that it has been, and so that's actually going to be growth positive probably before the end of the year. It's certainly going to be less of a drag than it has been up until now. Secondly, we know the Fed's on the job. They've cut rates hugely already. Thirdly, fiscal stimulus is on the way. Fourth, and unusually, the US dollar has weakened so far that exports are growing significantly faster than imports, and that's cushioning growth in the US. And fifth, and this is a little technical, but far and away the biggest single component in any recession, the biggest single movement in demand in any recession is the swing in the so-called stock or inventory cycle from running stock up, sometimes involuntarily because demand has dropped away, to running stock down. That's far and away the biggest single movement in any recession anywhere. It usually accounts for about 70% of the fall in GDP in the US. Right now, inventories in the US, except in durable manufacturing in the US, don't look excessive. And in any case, the stock cycle has become a smaller part of the overall economy over time as the economy sort of switched more towards services and away from goods, etc. So I think you can make a very, very strong case that this will be a mild recession in the US. But here's my problem. At this stage of what I think of as the forecasting cycle, the consensus view of economists always, always, always forecasts a mild recession. And sometimes they're right, but more often they're wrong. In fact, I thought I'd take a minute or two to run you through the stages of economic forecasting, because this is a regular pattern. I actually put an early version of this slide together during the last US recession in 2001. But here's how it goes. Economies spend most of their time growing, and they essentially because they grow up the stairs and then they fall down the lift shaft. And so, and while they're growing, of course, if you ask Mr. or Mrs. Consensus Economist what's going to happen, they always tell you, well, you know, growth as far as the eye can see. When economies are growing, basically the view is that it's just going to go on forever. Now, of course, it doesn't go on forever, but when the story changes, economists are, of course, surprised, but they're nevertheless still confident. And in 2007, that happened. This really refers to the US, but they realised growth's already slowed. They identified the culprit, housing. Everything else was doing okay. And so the universal view was there would be a soft landing. Now, just a quick definition about a recession. Usually in Australia, when you're in the media, sort of always define a recession in the technical sense, their word, and that is two successive quarters of falling GDP. That's not the definition in the US. Here's their definition. There's a body there called the National Bureau of Economic Research. And in the US, a recession is said to have occurred when the National Bureau of Economic Research says that a recession has occurred. They make the call. They look at a wide range of indicators. Incidentally, the committee that does this is called the Cycle Dating Committee. Now, the reasons for that are obvious to me now, but I lived in the US for 13 years, and I was always trying to get onto that committee, because I already had my own bike, and I misunderstood the rest of the function. So that's the definition of a recession. And, of course, during recessions, the unemployment rate, which has been coming down, turns around and goes up sharply. During a soft landing, the unemployment rate, which has been coming down, stops coming down, maybe drifts up a point or two or three. That's the difference. Using those definitions, in the post-war period in the United States, there have been 3 soft landings. There have been 10 recessions. Recessions occur a lot more often than soft landings. But of those 10 recessions, the number of them that have been successfully forecast by the consensus view of economists before they began is 0. We're always forecasting this mythical creature, almost mythical creature, soft landing. So we always get surprised. And this is sort of the stage we're at now. Recession's already begun. Surprised, but still confident. It will be a mild one. And you look at anybody that's got a recession in their Excel spreadsheets, and they've got a two quarters of falling output totaling 0.5%. And your average fall in output during the US recession is somewhere between 1.5% and 2%. But as I said, you can make the case right now for it being mild. And we're sort of morphing from three already into four. It's not that that forecasters are eternal optimists, it's that they're lagging indicators. Once we're in recession, you go to Mr. Consensus Forecaster, and you're already seeing this happen, and ask him, well, how much longer is it going to go on? And he'll tell you 6 to 9 months. Wait 3 months, go back to the same bloke, ask him how much longer now, and he'll say 6 to 9 months. And we never get any closer to the end of it until one day you go into his office and he says, well, it turns out recovery began some months ago. Just as we know. And I've shown you this basically because you will see those third and those fourth and fifth stages yet. Now, it's important to point out that it isn't just the United States where people have been revising their growth prospects down and down sharply. These are the so-called consensus forecasts for GDP or output growth for calendar year 2008. They're not mine. They're put together by panels of economists and analysts around the world. And there are so many numbers here because these forecasts are updated every month. So here's what I've shown you. In September last year, when people were asked, what's Australia going to grow by in 2008? What's New Zealand going to do, etc.? Those were their answers. Last column, the same question, but the answer was given in March. Now, how do you tell how people have been changing their minds? It's very easy, isn't it? You look along the lines. And if you look along the bottom line, you'll see that the world growth forecasts have been cut systematically. September was, in fact, the peak. In the previous 4 years, the only thing we ever did was lift our growth forecasts, and equity markets did well. Since September, we've been cutting them, and equity markets have been struggling. That's not the only thing that matters, but it does matter a lot. Look at the US. That's the source of the biggest downward revision. 1.4% growth cannot include a recession. So this number probably has to come down further yet because the consensus view still hasn't embraced recession in the US. Japan, still the world's second largest economy, those forecasts coming down, and there's talk of the R word there. But everywhere else, growth forecasts are clearly being shaved. Now, maybe this is just, of course they're being shaved, they're reflecting a weaker US, maybe that's the case, or maybe there is just a more general downward growth dynamic. Look at China. The thing about this is that it is very, very unusual for anybody ever to cut their forecast for China, and it has happened in the past 5 months. I mentioned I went there, and I saw that CEDAR illustrated my article with a picture of Shanghai, which is actually where I went. We visited a number of factories, and we visited an automobile factory there, a car factory there, which was state-of-the-art, beautiful place, very high capital labour ratio. Every car made at this place was for the domestic market, not one of them exported. So it's true, there is some organic growth in China, but if the US really tanks this year, it will have a big effect on China and hence on us. We visited a number of other factories, and I reckon the reason why they took us there was so that we would never again complain about our jobs. It's pretty grim. You know, these places, they're huge, they're dark, they're dirty, they're noisy, they're hot in the summer, they're cold in the winter. You don't see safety goggles, earmuffs, you don't see any safety equipment whatsoever. And I guess they've exported all of that stuff. But there's always a tourism highlight, and that must be why CD used the picture, because the TV tower in Pudong is in that picture. And I remember well on the Sunday, there were three busloads of us. It was a study trip, and we went to the TV tower and went up that. And then afterwards we came down, and I'm not making this up, they said, get back in the buses. They said, we're going to lunch. And then they said, we're going to lunch in Chinatown. How does that work? But if you've been to Shanghai, or if you go there, you can go to Chinatown. I figure at some stage, you know, when they were developing the city, maybe they looked around and asked themselves, what is it that the big successful cities all over the world have? And they figured, well, we better get one of them too. What does all this mean for Australia? Sliding growth and sliding growth elsewhere. The red line here is the US economic growth cycle, just the rate of growth over the previous year, and the yellow line is us. You're supposed to get two lessons. Number one, the U.S. matters a lot. Number two, it may not matter as much as it used to. So let's forget about the U.S. for a moment and just look at Australia. What this says is that in the year to the December quarter, the Australian economy grew by 3.9%. Domestic demand grew by, I believe, 5.7%. And the Reserve Bank looks at that and says, too strong. Can't go on. We're running out of room. We need to slow the Australian economy down. And, of course, that is why they have continued to raise rates so far. They wouldn't shrink from that view when they looked at the labour market. They'd see 2.7% employment growth in the last year, and they'd see an unemployment rate coming down, down, down to 4%, which is a genuine 33-year low. And, of course, the Reserve Bank's main concern, of course, is inflation. Their job is to keep headline CPI inflation between 2 and 3 on average over the course of the cycle. And this is how they've been doing. The yellow line is the headline CPI. Going back a couple of years, they raised rates three times in 2006 when inflation broke out of the box and hit 4% and then 3.9%. But then we raised rates twice last year when inflation was very, very low indeed. Indeed, when we raised rates during the election campaign for the first time ever, inflation was out of the bottom of the range. It was 1.9%. What on earth did they think they were doing? Did they hate the coalition that much? And the answer is no, they were doing their job. In order to understand why inflation was so low in mid-2007, you have to understand why it was so high in mid-2006. And we all remember that, don't we? There were two things that pushed inflation up as much as that. There was a bit of petrol, but it was mainly bananas. Now, I've been standing up on my feet and talking about economies for about 30 years, and I never thought I would seriously have to discuss the price of bananas. And I may not much longer, but of course when bananas came back down, the headline measure of inflation in year two terms comes back down also. And now the Reserve Bank's not stupid. They didn't raise rates in the first place because bananas went up, and it wasn't going to stop them raising rates when they came down. They know, if you like, that stuff like that comes along. They know that fruit happens. But if you're going to ignore what you're trying to target, what are you going to look at? And their answer is they cut into the CPI, do a bit of forensic science, and isolate a couple of measures that they think tell them about underlying inflation. And that's the red line. And so go back to 2005, 2006. Underlying inflation had been flatlining in the middle of the range, began to go up and they raised rates. In early 2007, they were desperate to raise rates again because they wanted to raise rates and get it out of the way well before the election. But underlying inflation did a bit of a head fake. Looked like it was improving. So they just didn't have a smoking gun of inflation to raise rates. But then in August and then November last year, that line stopped coming down, started to go up again, and so they raised rates. The last point there in the history, of course, is December quarter last year when underlying inflation rose again to 3.6%. And if you look back, that underlying inflation basically right now at a 17-year high. And you can't do the arithmetic that doesn't have it rise further in year two terms when we get the March quarter figure at the end of April. And so if the Reserve Bank was only focused on inflation, there's no question they'd raise rates again in May. But they've got other things to worry about, including what's going on in the US, including financial market turbulence. Let me point out they had that to worry about in January and didn't stop them raising rates in February. But the other thing, I guess, that the Reserve Bank may be able to discern is that the tightening that's gone on since August last year may finally be getting some traction. We've seen a precipitous fall in consumer confidence. There is talk about house prices weakening. Auction clearance rates have come down. There's talk about house prices falling in the western suburbs of Sydney. I've never been to the western suburbs in Sydney, of course, but apparently they are. For some time yet, both measures of inflation are going to be above the target range. And so long as that's the case, the Reserve Bank is going to have a bias to tighten, in my view. My suspicion is that they're hoping that they get some read in the next CPI published in late April, some read which will enable them to say, look, inflation's actually beginning to improve. Because I don't think they want to raise rates again, but we're an inflation-targeting central bank and inflation's out of the range. So it's going to be interesting. Now, this actually relates to something that Terry said. I thought that we'd just take a quick look at commodity prices. This is it's not the best index for Australia, but it's the only one for which I could find 50 years of history and somebody had already plotted nicely for me. It's real metal prices, so it doesn't have the coal in it, for example. Real means that we've taken overall prices out, and so it's how commodity prices have gone relative to overall prices. And I learned two things from the history. Number one, commodity prices have a long-run downward trend. And number two, when they spike up, they come down very quickly. Now, what are you going to do with those lessons going forward? First one, long-run downward trend, I think you just chuck that away. I think the China-India story and the other developing country story is so strong now, your trend in commodity prices is up. But I can't draw a trend starting from that low point or somewhere near that low point that doesn't go south of the high point where commodity prices are right now. And one day, and it may not be, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to be in the very near future, but one day in the near future, commodity prices are going to turn. Now, what does this have to do with Terry's point? Most of the revenue surprise in the federal budget, and it's happened 4 years in a row, and most of the revenue surprise has come in company taxes, and that's largely reflected profits made by the resource companies. And that's largely reflected the commodity price boom. It's no exaggeration to say the commodity price boom has been the biggest single source of the individual tax cuts that we've already had. Now, commodity prices may not turn this year, but one day soon they are going to turn. And to paraphrase what Terry said with respect to spending, if we hadn't had the tax cuts before then, we won't be getting them after that. Just a quick look at the outlook for the Australian economy. Every time I look at this outlook, I actually think it's not pessimistic enough in terms of growth. The yellow line you've already seen before, that's what was growing at 3.9% in the year to December. There's no question growth's coming down in Australia, but remember, that's the objective. The Reserve Bank wants to slow growth in order to take the heat out from under inflation. The risk, of course, when you try to slow growth by raising rates is that because monetary policy works with a lag, you never quite know when you've done enough, so you tend to keep going until you're sure. And the risk, I reckon, a year from now is that, if anything, growth will be lower than shown here. Certainly there's more chance it'll be less than 2 a year from now than that it will be greater than 4. Now, as you can see, we haven't had a recession in 17 years. And recoveries don't die of old age, but I'm finding it harder and harder to believe that we're going to go either 22 or 25 years without a recession. What's the significance of those two numbers? Well, when we elected St. Kevin last year, we gave him the sort of majority that suggests he's going to be there for at least 6 and maybe 9 years. If we can't go 25 years without a recession, it is very likely the next recession will take place while the Labor Party is on watch. And what do you think the coalition will make of that fact after the election after that? I think at some stage, Kevin Rudd may begin to wish that he'd won the next election rather than the one that he did win. Not that there's anything they can do about that now. Now, I thought I'd just take a look at medium-term growth prospects while I've still got a bit of time. I've gone back to the consensus forecasters and asked them, you know, where's the growth over the next 10 years? And they've given Australia a big tick. And not only are we at the top of the list here, but the gap between us and the next one down is bigger than any other gap in the table. Australia's growth prospects are assessed to be very strong indeed. But this is actually the wrong list, isn't it? These are the developed countries of the world. I've got another table with growth rates for the countries to the north. Who's top of that table? China. Who's second? India. Now, I've asked audiences actually twice in the past 3 weeks, who's third? And having stipulated growth rates in Asia twice, I've had somebody in the audience basically volunteer for third place, Brazil, which is actually quite a good answer because Brazil growth prospects are quite strong, with a singular exception that it's not in Asia. But you were right about number one and two, and you knew that, but what you may not have known is that a year ago, China's expected growth was like 8.3 and India's was 7.5. And again, the message there is the biggest growth story out there is still being reassessed upwards. Now, China is bigger now, and it's going to grow faster, and it's more commodity intensive, so it is so much more important. But 25 years from now, the Indian growth story then will be bigger than the Chinese growth story is then. And I say that with complete confidence, and my confidence comes from three factors. Number one, there's no way I'm going to be standing up in front of you 25 years from now, so in a sense, I don't care. Number two, if I can borrow from Cath Day Knight, it comes down to two words, demographics. By 2016, the Indian labour force will be falling, the Chinese labour force will be falling, and India's just got labour force growth for years and years and years, and that will drive longer, stronger growth. And I guess reason number three, if you want to grow rapidly for a very long period of time, it really helps if you start from a very low base. And, of course, India does. Now, I just thought I'd close with, since I'm the financial sector economist here, I thought I'd give you some view about this. I've got the currency, as you see, coming down. I've got no change in the cash rate, although there's still a risk. And I've got the share market. I guess you could call that slow gains. Just very quickly there, on the currency, I put this chart up even when I'm talking to audiences that don't care one thing about the currency, and I put it up because I think it's a great chart. The red line here is the Australian dollar and US cents, and you look that way. And the yellow line is a trade-weighted index of the US dollar. It shows the US dollar against the currencies of the developed world that the US trades with. And I've inverted that line, so when the yellow line's going up, that's the US dollar going down, and when it's going down, that's the US dollar going up. Now, when you look at the chart, do you see two lines that are broadly moving together? If that is what you do see, then essentially what that means is that most of the movement in the US, not all of it, but most of the movement in the Australian dollar in the past 7 years has actually been them and not us. When we've gone up, usually because they've gone down. Started the point where those two lines are together in late 2006, we were 75 cents and we'd been there for some time. And we're now 92, but what the chart shows you is the movement from 75 to about 90 has nothing whatsoever to do with Australia. It's them. And it's only that extra bit, and there has been quite a bit of extra bit in the last year, that's us rather than them. Incidentally, start where the two lines come apart in early 2007. That actually happened when people were basically climbing back into equity markets after the Shanghai correction. And essentially, they were taking on more risk, and when they take on more risk, the Australian dollar tended to get bid up. And then, between mid-July and mid-August, equity markets came down sharply, and so did we. Equity markets turned up and went up strongly, so did our currency. Equity markets turned again in October last year, and our currency began to come back down. Now, by this time, I've spotted the pattern. And I told our asset managers, found a way to forecast the Australian dollar. All you've got to do is forecast equities, and you'll be able to do that. And they began to use that, basically, in their thinking, and as soon as they began to use it, the relationship broke down. This happens quite often. I think it used to be called Goodhart's Law. I think of it more generally as, you think you found something that's built in stone and turns out not to be. I think of it really as it's a disease suffered by forecasters. It's called premature extrapolation. And the forecasters all suffer from it from time to time. There's sort of a cure. What you do is you keep on forecasting, but while you're forecasting, you think about something else. Essentially, we've been wasting our time trying to figure out why the Australian dollar is quite so strong, because, as I show you, it's really the US dollar. Now, just close with a couple of charts. This shows you the correction in the ASX 200 to date. It's looking a bit ominous, and it will come down almost certainly in the next month. And this is far bigger than, certainly in points terms, is the biggest correction, obviously, we've ever had. But a couple of charts that to give you some cause for hope. This is the price. Somebody who's a lot smarter than I am, and there's no shortage of candidates there, has calculated price-earnings ratio for the entire world market. And the last point actually was plotted on the 22nd of January, that dark day. And on that day, the price-earnings ratio which is some sort of measure of the expensiveness or cheapness of the market, was at an 18-year low. Now, of course, a price-earnings ratio is only as good, I will admit, as the earnings forecast that underlies it. But on that day, it was at an 18-year low, and the Australian market was at a 13-year low. Now, do the following. We've been here several times in the post-war period. International markets have been there several times in the post-war period. Go back and assume that a hypothetical investor buys a bucket of stocks, if you like, that represent the market on any day in which the P/E ratio is this low or lower, and then ask what happens to that bloke over the next year. And over the next year, in such a hypothetical exercise, that hypothetical investor has always made money. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean they make money over the next 1, 2, or 3 months. And, of course, as the US economy as we find out more about that, it's entirely and as you know the financial sector problems in the US work their way out, it's entirely possible that equity markets will go lower first. But somewhere out there, there's a buying opportunity. Indeed, this shows you the recessions, peaks and troughs, and also the S&P peaks and troughs by month. And the market always leads. The second last column shows you the in March when this chart was put together relative to October, the market was down 14%. That's still relatively small by the standards of past recessions. But have a look at what happens in the last column once the market does turn. It's sort of worthwhile, actually. I'm not licensed to give financial advice, but in a sense, I reckon it's too late to sell, because if you sell now, the last column is what you might miss out on eventually. I'm not licensed to give financial advice. If I can summarise just briefly here, world economic growth has slowed significantly. I reckon a mild recession in the US is priced in, but the big question there is, could it be worse? The Australian economy is still doing well, despite, you know, there are some signs that monetary tightening is having an effect. As a result, there's still a chance that interest rates will rise further. The exchange rate, I think, comes off a bit, but will remain strong, and stocks are cheap. The risk is they get cheaper in the short term. I've left the most important message to last, and that's this one. So I'll stop there. Thank you.